Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. While disastrous, Christopher Morris writes in his new book, The Big Muddy, Hurricane Katrina was not truly natural because people had created the conditions that made it possible. People built the faulty levees. People meddled with the coastal environment, depriving New Orleans of a natural barrier. People built and paved over wetlands, which consequently dried up and caused the city to sink. People put housing developments in low-lying districts. To give us the long-term perspective on how people have lived alongside the Mississippi River from the time of Hernando de Soto to the present is Christopher Morris. It's great to have you with us today on Counterpoint.
It's great to be here.
Chris, let's start with the big argument of the Big Muddy. What did you want to show in writing an environmental history of the Mississippi and its people from Hernando de Soto to Hurricane Katrina, as your subtitle puts it?
Well, I started with the concept or the idea of the Mississippi Valley as a naturally wet place. Hurricanes hit the coast when the river overtops its banks and sprawls out across the floodplain. On the one hand, these are disasters for a lot of people. On the other hand, this is just the river and the Gulf Coast environment doing what it always does and always has done. And so I began my history with the idea that this was a wet place that only more recently was dried by people primarily for agriculture. And as they dried it, they adapted themselves and the way they lived and worked to this dry environment. And then when it continued to flood, the flooding became something unnatural or disastrous, a problem to be solved, a problem for which people were to blame. I guess my argument is that the lower Mississippi Valley and the New Orleans area has really been completely misunderstood and misrepresented because of recent history. And if you go back 500 years or more, what you find is thousands and thousands of people living in this place and living in it with all the water, the flooding and the hurricanes and so forth, and thriving. And there's something that we can learn from that.
And I want to talk a little bit more about that from the early history forward, but just fill in a few more of the gaps. When you say it's recent history, it's really beginning in the 18th century and with European colonization in this area initially. And it's really about the separation of the river from the land. Say a little bit more about that.
Okay. All right. The lower Mississippi Valley is basically a muddy place. If we think of mud as a substance unto itself, rather than as just a mixture of land and water, then you understand what the lower Mississippi Valley is. And what it's been turned into is not mud so much as dry land on one side of the levee and water on the other side. So water and land have been separated. This process began in the 18th century with the French in their efforts to turn the lowest parts of the valley into farmland. Farmland suitable for their crops, wheat in particular, which could not stand much water or much moisture in the air. And in their effort to settle in the area and plant the crops that they were familiar with, they tried to keep the water off the land. They were only somewhat successful early on in the 18th century, but they got the process going. Really, the drying of the valley occurred after the Louisiana Purchase. When the area became part of the United States, it was no longer a distant colony of a European empire, but it was now part of the continental empire of the United States, and all the resources of the United States were in time brought to bear on the lower valley in the struggle to keep the water off the land and to keep the land dry on the dry side of the levee. The drying of the land really proceeded at a fairly rapid rate in maybe the 1830s or so. And by the start of the 20th century, it was done. And the rest of the 20th century was spent fixing the problems that were caused primarily by the drying of the land in the 19th century. So when I say it was a fairly recent history to dry this land, it's really only about 150 years.
Well, let's go back just a little bit further. Let's go back the full 500 years, as you suggest. Hernando de Soto was the first European explorer in the region. And you write that, quote, Soto did not find a pristine wilderness. Along the river's native peoples burned cane brakes and forests to clear land for settlements and small gardens. They cleared open areas beneath pecan and other fruit and nut trees to facilitate gathering, and otherwise disrupted plant ecologies. So is human interaction with the environment invariably ecologically destructive?
No, it's not. The cultures that Hernando de Soto encountered were, in some cases, some of them were overextending their agriculture to the point of not being sustainable. And we now know, anthropologists now tell us, that there was almost certainly an ecological dimension to the demise of the Mississippian cultures of the central Mississippi Valley and parts of the lower Mississippi Valley. And Hernando de Soto encountered some of these cultures. But farther down the river, certainly from Memphis on down, there were a lot of native cultures that practiced very little agriculture, some on the high grounds that they cleared, but they gathered most of their food from the wetlands. They lived off fish and shellfish, small fur-bearing animals, raccoons and opossums, those sorts of creatures. Waterfowl were very much an important part of their diet. And they were able to live off of these animals and did not have to practice agriculture, and so did not very much, yet managed to build very large, by the standards of North America at the time, large and flourishing civilizations and complicated cultures with ceremonial architecture. The mounds are still there.
I think you said at one point those mounds are even larger than the pyramids in Egypt.
Some of them are. Certainly the Emerald Mound down in the area of Natchez is. The Monk's Mound at Cahokia, which is across the river from St. Louis, is in terms of volume. And some of these mound-building societies were very old. Archaeologists are still surprising themselves with their carbon dating of some of these sites and finding out how very old some of these permanent settlements were. And without any evidence of agriculture, or very little. It's one of the regions of North America that made use of maize cultivation in an extensive way, one of the last places in North America to do so. By the time Hernando de Soto came, you could find maize fields all around the Mississippi Valley. But in the lower Mississippi Valley, there were few, and those who were practicing agriculture had only been doing so for a few centuries, so it was a new thing.
So you're describing native peoples with complicated culture, complicated interaction with the environment, certainly having some kind of an imprint on that environment, but living in an ecologically sustainable way with that environment. Right. I want to talk about how that changed with European colonization in that area. And I guess part of the way that we can get to this is you tell the story of how the Mississippi got its name and the way in which that reflects the history of the Delta that you narrate in the first couple of chapters. When Native Americans begin to vie with Europeans who begin to encroach into this area. Tell us, how did the Mississippi River get its name and what that indicates about the colonial period?
It's an Ojibwe word, meaning big river or great river. And it became the name for the whole river because the whole river became part of the French North American Empire. So one of the historical breaks, I suppose, between what is known as the prehistoric period, before Europeans arrived, and what came after was, before the French, certainly, the river was not used or claimed by one group or one nation from top to bottom. So it had several names. The Ojibwe of Wisconsin and Minnesota, the Great Lakes region, had one name for it. But all the way down the valley, people had their own names for the river. Mississippi stuck because the French ended up claiming the entire river. The Spanish had their names for it, but their names never stuck because they didn't maintain their hold on the river, and they only ever encountered the lowest part of the river anyway. So the French came from the north, from Canada. They first heard about the river through Algonquin-speaking peoples like the Ojibwe, and that's the name that they knew. And they were the first Europeans to learn that the river that they knew in the Great Lakes region was the same river that emptied into the Gulf. And that was, for Europeans, that was an important discovery. There were all sorts of theories about where the river that started in what is now Minnesota, where it ended up. Did it go west? There were some who hoped that it went into the Bay of California and maybe all the way across the continent to the Pacific. And for people who encountered the mouth of the river on the coast, they didn't know that the river that we now know as the Mississippi River was the same one that came from the Lake Superior region. There were some people who thought that the Mississippi River flowed towards the southwest and then emptied onto the Gulf or into the Gulf on what is now the Texas coast. The French, LaSalle in particular, was the first one to confirm for certain, because he canoed it from top to bottom, that the Mississippi River, the river that the Ojibwe called the Mississippi, was in fact the same river that flowed all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And so the name stuck.
And once it was navigated by Europeans and then mapped by Europeans and then claimed by Europeans, the river subsequently became known as the Mississippi River. So you tell another fascinating story, and having just eaten gumbo prepared by my wife, who hails from Baton Rouge, I couldn't help thinking that this food really encapsulates the next chapter in the history of the Lower Mississippi when this territory came under French control. So how did gumbo develop, and what does its development indicate about the French colonial adventure in this region?
Rice cultivation was the way in which the French initially adapted themselves to the wet environment. Rice was absolutely crucial for the French because it was a food that they were familiar with. They never acquired the taste for maize or corn. They tried and tried to grow wheat. They have to have their baguettes, and so they want wheat, and they couldn't grow it. And they ended up learning that rice could be planted successfully in the wetlands of the Lower Mississippi Valley. When they did that, they, as I see it, were adapting themselves to this naturally wet environment. So it was an ecological transformation that was not necessarily harmful, even though it meant clearing some forests, but it meant adapting themselves to this naturally wet place. But it gave them a foothold in this environment and then gave them the courage to begin to try to control and transform this naturally wet environment. Once they could live off of it and fully incorporate rice cultivation into their culture, then they began to try or to seek ways to adapt the environment to them rather than adapting to the environment. And you can see this in the way rice, I think, was incorporated into the French culture. So gumbo is an iconic dish in Louisiana, and cultural historians always like to point to the okra as an African ingredient and the sassafras as a Native American ingredient, and it's maybe seasoned with some andouille sausage and pork. That's European, so it's an amalgamation of the three major cultures of Louisiana. And all of that's true. But what gets forgotten in this dish is the rice. Whenever you order a bowl of gumbo, a scoop of rice is put in the bowl and the gumbo is ladled over top of it. It turns out that rice has a place of long standing in French culinary history as a thickener for thin broths. They like to use bread, but in the shortage of bread, they used rice. And that's exactly what gumbo is. And so whatever gumbo is in Louisiana culture, it also represents the French bringing their culture to the wetlands of Louisiana.
And effectively, without rice, New Orleans would never have been able to sustain itself as the capital of the French Empire. And therefore, in a sense, gumbo kind of stands for the beginnings of that southernmost point on the Delta.
In many ways, it does. The founder of New Orleans, Bienville, wanted to establish his colonial capital on the Mississippi River as close to the mouth of the river as possible. And he couldn't find a place that was sufficiently dry, and French farmers were not able to raise crops. And if he couldn't feed his soldiers, then there was no point in establishing a fort there. So he kept his capital on the coast. Sometimes it was in Mobile and sometimes it was in Biloxi. But rice showed that they could support themselves in the wetland environments. The first successful crops were in 1715 or thereabouts, and Bienville decided in 1718 that he could then build his colonial capital.
And I guess it's not only okra that is an ingredient that goes into it, but even rice cultivation was brought partly by the African laborers who actually developed the rice. So really the whole history is right there in the dish. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Christopher Morris about his new book, The Big Muddy, An Environmental History of the Mississippi and Its Peoples from Hernando de Soto to Hurricane Katrina. Now, after the Louisiana Purchase, in a chapter you title King Cotton Meets Big Muddy, you write about how over the 19th century, continuing a trend begun by the French, rice and sugar replaced forests and swamps below Baton Rouge. Above Baton Rouge, land was cleared and drained for cotton. Now, cotton is a crop that cannot tolerate floods. So tell us why, in this natural wetland ecosystem, all of this became cotton country.
If you were a cotton planter, or a wannabe cotton planter, and you stood on the bluff at Memphis, and you looked west over that wetland in, say, 1820, what you looked at was the most perfect farmland you could ever imagine. The topsoil was 5 feet or more deep, and I mean rich topsoil. It was flat, which makes for easy plowing. And this was the most perfect cotton land, except that it was covered in water. All you had to do was clear away the water and the wetland forests, and you would have perfect cotton land. So the invitation to change it, to transform it, to dry it, was simply too tempting. The prices that cotton brought encouraged people to do it. It was an incredible task, and it was a task borne by the slaves. So it was not small farmers who established cotton plantations. These were cotton planters who were capitalized by family and friends, fathers primarily, sending younger sons into Louisiana and the Arkansas Delta to clear land for cotton. But it was their slaves primarily who did it and bore the human costs of clearing this land, the dangers to their health, and it was incredibly difficult. Much of this region actually wasn't fully cleared and planted until after the Civil War, towards the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century in the case of the Mississippi Delta.
But the exploitation of the Delta for cotton production would end up having huge unintended consequences, even in the form of things like drought, but also disease and other consequences. Tell us a little bit more about how a natural wetland experiences drought, and right. How did altering the environment actually help create disease and other pathologies that came along in this region?
In the 1890s, there were a series of droughts almost every year, and it was perplexing to the people who lived in some of the parishes and counties along the river. I think maybe it was Concordia Parish. There was a report in the newspaper that there was no drinking water anymore. It's dried up. By the 1890s, the water was all on the riverside of the levee, and the land was dry on the dry side for cotton, which is fine if there is not a drought. But as we know, droughts happen. There are summers when there is less rainfall than average. Before the levees contained all the water on the riverside, when the river used to spill out over the floodplain annually in the late spring, the water soaked into the land and kept it wet over the course of the summer, so that the soil was still moist even through a dry summer. But this was no longer the case by the 1890s. Not only were there droughts in the 1890s, there were also floods. Floods of the sort that threatened towns and settlements along the river, threatened to break through the levees. So you have simultaneously land that is too dry because there's no water on it, and the farmers are panicked that their crops are going to dry up. But they're also panicking because the river is rising on the wet side of the levee and threatening to burst through and wash their crops away. This, to me, is a sign of a troubled landscape.
And there were other signs of a troubled landscape. So, for example, yellow fever, it turns out, which is intrinsic in the history of Memphis in terms of creating all of the conditions that resulted in modern-day Memphis, is also a byproduct of this. Tell us how that's the case.
It is, yes. The yellow fever of 1878 in Memphis is about as bad as it gets. And it wasn't just Memphis. Other river towns were hit as well. And New Orleans was famous for its yellow fever epidemic. epidemics. Yellow fever is borne by a particular type of mosquito that is not indigenous, but has arrived with Europeans on ships and has adapted actually to urban areas in the environment, primarily because it needs still water in order to reproduce itself. And still water is found in cisterns, barrels, open containers of various sorts, puddles and pools on streets, and also in fields. The transformation of the Lower Valley environment for agriculture shaped the relationship between water and the land. It used to be that the river flooded and spilled out over the land, and then the water slowly receded. The water was always moving, first over the land and then off the land back into the river. But the levees, while they kept river water off the land, they trapped rainwater on the land, and it pooled, and it sat there still, and it was the perfect place for these mosquitoes to breed, the sorts of mosquitoes that carried yellow fever. So the combination of urban growth, places like Memphis and Vicksburg and New Orleans really grew as the countryside grew. So the transformation of the countryside was absolutely instrumental for the growth of urban areas. It's part of the same process. And the urban areas created the sorts of water environments, the still pools of water in containers for these mosquitoes, just as puddles of water behind the levees on the cotton fields also created the environment for these mosquitoes. But other diseases as well came with the spread of agriculture. Malaria, for example. It's a mosquito actually that was here in North America, but the disease itself was the change of the environment made the valley a better place for malaria to thrive. And it turns out there was a mosquito that was here that's the perfect malaria carrier.
So, Chris, just on the basis of this long history that you've been explaining, you really show how Hurricane Katrina and before it, other massive floods like the Great Flood of 1927 were disastrous, but they were not natural. They're all a result of history and human choices. And you also explain that a lot of what accounts for the history in the Delta has to do with how the environment was imagined or thought about. So has the thinking about the environment of the Delta changed post-Katrina? Was Katrina the wake-up call that we needed to recognize the impact on the environment that humans have had that you've been speaking about?
I hope it was a wake-up call. It's too soon to tell. The debates over the future of New Orleans and the Valley go on. I mean, in New Orleans itself, there are the debates over whether to rebuild the city as it was before, but with better levees and a better pumping system to keep the water out. It's a fantasy to think that the place was ever really dried. Think of the droughts, the diseases like yellow fever, and the periodic disastrous floods as the way this naturally wet place reasserts itself as a wet place over and over again. So what we've really done over the last 200 years is repress the water, but we haven't gotten rid of it. And one way or another, it comes back. It may come back in the form of a major flood. It may come back in the form of a drought that is the result of our efforts to control the water. It may come back in the form of mosquitoes. We don't know how it's going to come back. We can't easily predict. As I see it, the way to deal with this problem is to stop repressing the water and figure out how we can live with it. People have done that in the past, and not just all the way back to the Native American societies, to the Plaquemine peoples and others. But even as recently as the 1849 flood in New Orleans, which was one of the worst floods the city had ever experienced until Katrina, as terrible as it was for the people who lived there, they never for a moment imagined that they lived in a place that should never flood. They knew it was going to flood. And they carried on as best they could. They went to work. The market remained open. Kids played in the water. They played with water moccasins, which terrifies me, but didn't terrify them. Young men and women courted one another in rowboats. People sat on their front porches and fished. They waded through the water to get around. They moved upstairs for 6 weeks if they had an upper story in their home. The French actually built two-story homes in much of New Orleans so that they would have a place of refuge during floods. They never expected or believed that the city could be made safe from flooding. They learned how to live with it. And we have to learn from that lesson.
And we don't have to look back to 1849 for our examples. I mean, one of the things you do in the last chapter of the book is point to cities that are also on natural wetlands, but that are living in a much more economically mediated relationship to that wet environment. Tell us a little bit about that experiment in Europe and how it is that maybe New Orleans could learn from that example.
There are an awful lot of people in Rotterdam and in Amsterdam, areas below sea level, the mouth of the Rhine River system, and they allow the water to mingle on the land in and about where they live. Much of their agriculture is increasingly hydroponic. Many of their homes are floating homes. If they aren't, in fact, elevated, they can rise and fall with the water. And so while they protect themselves from disastrous floods, part of the way they do that is by allowing the river and the sea to flood them a little bit. And that takes the pressure off the major floods. They do have their very sophisticated gates on the sea to try to keep a rising ocean from inundating them. But because they incorporate water into their human environment on a daily basis, it reduces the probability of a disastrous flood. It also prepares the people for flooding. I was really struck with the Hurricane Katrina disaster at how terrified people were of the water. And there were all sorts of horror stories about what was in the water and how it was going to contaminate the city and would the city even be habitable after it had been touched by the surrounding waters. I don't know what the percentage is of the population in New Orleans that doesn't know how to swim, but I suspect it's high. If you don't know how to swim and you live in Dallas, where I live, then that's okay. But if you live below sea level and you don't know how to swim, there's something there that's not making much sense, I think, because you're going to be afraid of the water. Incorporate the water into your life on a daily basis the way the Dutch do, and you won't be so afraid of it. And you'll be better equipped to handle the flooding when it does happen, because it will happen.
And a big part of the story is really the call not to continue to fantasize about what the environment is. That is, this is not a place in which there is water on one side and land on the other side and ne'er the twain shall meet. Rather, it's a natural wetland. And part of what is going to make living in this environment sustainable is recognizing that there has to be a greater permeability between the two, and that every effort to separate out the two has direct consequences, sometimes unintended, that can be disastrous.
Yes. I mean, you separate the two, and one way or another, they mix. So you separate the land and water in one way, and the two rejoin in some other way. And if you're not expecting it, then it's going to be a disaster.
And that's exactly how your book gets its title, The Big Muddy. Thanks so much for being with us here today to explicate what it is that you explore in it.
My pleasure.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the News menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.